Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument, and has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro, and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. We're going to take a look at more into the history of the studio music scene and studio guitar players. Now, we all are very familiar with the Wrecking Crew and the importance of the Wrecking Crew. But tonight, my guest is going to take us even farther back before the Wrecking Crew, and actually the major influence of what was happening that evolved into the Wrecking Crew. My guest is Jim LaDiana, and he wrote this book called Strings of Memories. And he talks about all these players that, in reading the book, it was amazing because I recognized a lot of the names. I didn't really associate with them in terms of, well, I knew some of them were session players, but I knew them as jazz players and solo artists. But for like example, I forgot that Bob Bain, he had played, I've seen him for years play on the Tonight Show, or in the Tonight Show Orchestra for many, many years as a little kid watching it at late night. I would sneak and listen and watch TV. It's amazing, the musical heritage. And one of the other things that I noticed in reading the book was how much these guys influenced the development of the guitar of today, the electric guitar, and even before that, the archtop guitar, because all of these guys were playing in bands, and in the early days, there were no amps, there were no pickups, and they had to cut through an orchestra. So anyway, I want to welcome Jim. Jim, it's great to have you on the show.
Hey, Jeff, nice to be here. Thank you.
And first, before we get into the book, briefly, give us a little bit of your background.
Okay, well, the late 30s, early 40s, my father was a singer in New York City, kind of a regional hit, and consequently, he would play music all the time at the house, and it was wild because I'd hear the music between the bedroom and the living room and the old Victrolas, and I'd hear these instruments and the guitars, and boy, it just got to me, really, and when I went out to look out who was playing, most of the albums back then, they never listed any of the players, never listed anything. And that always bothered me. And I kind of felt that way as I continued my love for music and guitar. I kept wanting to increase my knowledge of, where did this all begin? And several of the gentlemen that I write about in the book, I refer to as pioneers. Because at that time, there was nothing else before them to really grasp from, to influence them. They were creating this stuff as they were playing in the studios and the orchestras. But I started playing guitar at about 13, 14 years old. Of course, everybody was shocked by the Beatles, and I think that kind of gave me a little incentive like many other people. But the guitar, my grandfather played the guitar, and anytime I saw him play it, he had this great smile on his face. Of course, being Italian heritage, you know, everybody would sit around and have a lot of good times, a little wine, a little this, a little that. Everybody had a great time. And I thought, geez, look at everybody circling around my grandfather, emanating around him, and he had a big old smile on his face. I said, there's something there that I want to feel myself. And so I pursued the guitar and played a lot back east, Cafe Wa and Joel Heller's Eighth Wonder and all that kind of stuff, and toured around the East Coast a little bit and moved out here in the late 70s. But just before I did, I'd say probably the early 70s, I got hit by the jazz guitar bug.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the earliest albums I heard, that it was kind of commercial at the time, was the George Benson Breezin album. It was a wonderful album, but mm-hmm. it was his other playing, not just Masquerade, but some of the other work that he was doing on the tunes. And I said, oh my gosh, you know, it's so clean, so clear. Everything is just balanced, and it just really struck me really hard, and I fell in love with it just like that. I was a slave to jazz guitar, and not long after, I remember driving, and I heard the guitar on the radio. I said, what the heck? And I pulled over. I couldn't believe I was here. It was Pat Martino, and it literally floored me. I had to pull over and stop, because I'd never heard anything quite like that before. So that just gave me another push, and moving out to California, you know, being out here in the music capital of the world, you start to hear names. You start to visit some of these music stores. Like there was the guitar. Oh my gosh, it escapes you right now.
Well, there was Wallach's Music City on Sunset Wallach's and Vine.
And then you had Barney Kessel and a lot of these guys who were actually playing in the studios, but they wanted to do more. So they actually opened up stores. So they had shops.
Mm-hmm.
All these great people would come in, and again, you had maybe a Fender guitar, a Gibson guitar, maybe a Gretsch, you know, a Fender Princeton Reverb, and that was about it. There wasn't really a whole lot. Maybe a Mel Bay guitar method book.
I remember Mel Bay.
You know, Black Diamond strings.
Yes.
Of course, I'd be listening to these guitar players, and I'd say, how the heck did they, you know, how do they get in these sounds? And I realized, you know, they were light gauge strings, which was just a revelation to me. And of course, when I got my first Fender amp, a Fender Vibralux, pre-CBS, reverb, it was like the Ten Commandments that just,
you know,
appeared in my house. You know? But it was something like that that just kept growing in my essence that I just couldn't deny. And I've always wondered about the history of things and the guitar and where do things start. You know, everything has a beginning. You know, I work with young people and they talk to me about, you know, Eric Clapton and Santana, and they're all fine guitar players, but it happened many, many, many years preceding that. Just like I write about George Van Epps, who created the seven-string guitar. A lot of these heavy metal guys think it's a contemporary instrument when it was recreated in the late 30s. Only because he needed more harmony, so he was playing three parts at a time. And I like to think that if people had a little more knowledge of where things came from, I think they'd have a greater respect of their craft or what they're doing. They'd be a heck of a lot knowledgeable. And when you hear these stories, I think you search them out. You want to hear some of these old-time players. You want to hear they're playing these archtop guitars I refer to as yachts. Because they're these monster instruments, and plus their strings are like piano wire, and they would be so masterful and so clean and so direct with their playing. I remember speaking to Bob Bain when they would do these sessions with the big bands. It was just one microphone.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes Bob would have to get up on a ladder, because there were no pickups, no amps or anything. He'd be up the top of the ladder, closest to the microphone, so you could hear his chinka chinka chinka. You know, you could hear that chunk, because the rhythm makes the world go round. And guitars, initially, they were kind of in the background. Of course, banjo was king in the 1800s, early 1900s, and the guitar
turn,
was...
Yeah, the turn of the century, banjo was... And it cut through, and it was used a lot in bands.
Exactly, and so... With the guitar, keeping that rhythm going, I mean, the rhythm never ends. And with the onset of the pickups, it was just like Star Wars. I mean, everything just opened up. And all of a sudden, the guitar started to take a little more important role. In fact, Andre Previn put out an album called Three Little Words, and he wrote some of the earliest guitar parts for recording, which Bob Bain also recorded. And Bob Bain, the reason why I was so intrigued with Bob is because he was one of the earliest guitarists that conquered the books. He was such a great reader. There was the Ozzie and Harriet show, and it had this insane book with all kinds of string sections and guitar players. There's no way a guitar player could play it. And then Bob comes in and nails it, and bam, you know, Bob is the name of the era, you know, and he starts, of course, getting all this work, and he became first call, first chair guitarist, you know, at many of the greatest studios on the planet.
Yeah.
And he just circulated, you know, from studio to the studio, and we hear his playing, and Tony Rizzi.
Well, Tony Rizzi, I remember that. I heard stories about those books. I mean, even Lee told me he was like, that stuff's tough
oh,
to read.
Yeah, when he had the...
And he would just have you read it, and it was like a big thing at the Musicians Union to hear these guys rip through those things.
The Wire Choir, and I've talked to, in the book, Grant Geisman and Tim Maine and some of these guys who were there, and I can't imagine, because you listen to the album, and you hear these five guitar parts just soaring, so effortlessly, like a sax, like super sax.
Right.
And then I hear stories about how wonderful the sessions were and how people clamored to get in there, or just they would just hang out and just to watch it all. And of course, Tony was such a sweet guy. And, you know, it's almost kind of reminds me, like I almost knew him from talking to Joel Jewell and Frank Potenza and people like that. He sounded like the sweetest guy, would give you the shirt off his back, would welcome anyone in, but yet he was playing this mind-boggling music that only the cream could play.
Right.
And to play that book was
if you could play that book, you were good. that's what I heard. I mean, I never tried it, nor would I even dare. But I want to make two points around the turn of the century. There's two significant things that I think is important that's brought out in the book, and I want you to elaborate a little bit more. First of all, was we were talking just a little bit before the show, the difference in the function of the guitar in big band era. And later on in pop and rock, it changed dramatically in the sense that the main function of the rhythm guitar in big band was the timekeeper. That was the rhythm section. That was the key. It wasn't the drums. The drums were doing accents or doing fancy little fills and doing things to enhance the breaks and the stings that the brass or whatever instruments were, or the other instruments were doing. And the reason I mention that is because in terms of what these guys were doing in big band, and remember in the, around the 20s or so when this all was starting in the book in terms of these orchestras and stuff that were touring, there were no pickups. There were no amplifiers at that point. So these guys were playing acoustic instruments. So the demands that they needed, you notice... You'll see pictures of some of the guitars that Gibson was making and Epiphone were making. These were huge, big, deep body jazz archtop guitars. And basically, and again, you were saying they were using heavier gauge strings, playing very hard on them. Mm-hmm. So they're projecting to make, they were loud. They're loud instruments. And a good archtop guitar cuts really well. And so that was the function, whereas in pop music, in rock, later in rock, the drummer became the main timekeeper. And the guitar player would do like harmonic, with chords. He would give the, you know, because a lot of that music was the vocalist and then there was the rhythm section under it. So he might give the harmonic progression or he would do the lead. And then, which leads me to the next major breakthrough is when the guitar got louder with the pickup, it allowed the guitarist to solo. And that's a significant thing that happened because that changed where the guitar could go. It was no longer just a rhythm instrument. It was no longer a, you know, percussive type instrument. It was an expressive melodic instrument. Now, I'm not sure everybody attributes that first starting with Charlie Christian, but was he actually the first to do single note melodies, or was it one of the, because you mentioned a book like, for example, Eddie Lang, and I think George Van Epps was another one too from the older era that started doing, I forgot which one was who was playing with Bing Crosby.
It was Eddie Lang.
Eddie Lang, and he's like, do a run here or something like that. Yes. So, it you know was who was the first or when did it really start?
Who's the first? You know,
because everybody attributes Charlie Christian as being the innovator.
Well, Charlie, you know, when he made that big breakthrough with Benny Goodman, you know, when they threw his amp on stage and he started soloing, and you know, the world of guitar changed. And that attribute, yes, to the pickup back then, they weren't the greatest pickups, but they did project the guitar. Before that, you're absolutely right. These huge archtop guitars were just rhythm machines, and I didn't realize until I started to get into the book that the guys were just, you know, hired to play rhythm guitar. That's all. They never soloed. They just played rhythm guitar, and some people might poo-poo that and say, oh, rhythm guitar, what's the big deal? All right, you try it for a couple minutes. Just play a two-chord vamp and see how accurate and precise you can be without technology assisting you.
Yeah.
Very difficult. But it does cut. And if you listen to big bands, try to solo out the guitar player, and that guy will keep – he's like the metronome for the band.
Right.
And he just solid, and like you say, the drummers are playing the fills and the horns are playing these little accents and things like this, but the guitar never stopped.
Well, it's interesting. One of the things Duke, I was taught under Duke Miller when I was at SC, and what Duke told me, he said, the trick with rhythm guitar, he says, is you don't notice it. When you hear those big band arrangements, the guitar is there, but you're hearing right. all the stuff. And you're not really noticing it, but it's there, and it's the glue that keeps it together. He said, "Now, you know, play, and he demonstrated this to us. He did like rhythm. There was like a little trio, or whatever, and they're playing. And then he took the guitar out, and it was like a hole.
Yeah.
So it's one of those subtle things where you it's not meant to be noticed, but you notice when it's not there, And that was interesting, that blend and the way it cut. It wasn't a real sustaining tone. And that was another issue. The pickups, as you said, the first ones weren't great. Mm-hmm. The amps weren't that, you know, as they, you know, these, you know, when you had a full brass section just blowing, and then you had this little amp, they turned it up and it started breaking up. And the original idea of the pickup was just to enhance the acoustic quality. Whereas it's when you started getting into cranking it up and the distortion of the pickup not accurately, all of a sudden that created another sound, you know, and that was like with blues and rock later, the whole thing was just, you know, it was just distorting the guitar or distorting the signal made this other sound that became the most desirable.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, but that's true. But then, back then, they weren't looking at that. And the guitar companies, too, they were trying to just accurately elevate the volume to cover them, the guitar, so you could hear it in a band situation as efficiently as possible. And the same thing, like with, that's really like a, you know, like a PA system. It's supposed to reinforce the sound, not change it.
Right.
You know, and but it was interesting because as they were playing and the thing was distorting and they got more sustain and it evolved. So when you hear some of these earlier recordings of these jazz players just taking it to town, you notice the tone. I mean, yeah, they're playing live, the amp's breaking up, but they're getting sustain. They're getting, you know, this kind of tonal quality from the distortion. That's very pleasing, and you know, it's more obvious in blues because they're holding the notes, whereas jazz players tend to play more scalar, and but even in the chord melody stuff, and now you have like, you know, a guitar player playing where he does an intro and then the singer comes in, so right. It's a featured, and remember again at the time before. These players came in, before the jazz players and the archtops came in, the only guitars, there were steel string guitars. You know, Martin had been making guitars in the 1700s, and there were people playing, you know, like in country and western and, you know, folk music. And then gut string classical guitar, but that was basically it. And they weren't amplified either. They were just basically, you know. And I always wondered for a long time why they didn't use like a Martin dreadnought in a big band. But now I realize that the function of that rhythm, you don't want the sustain that right. a Martin D28 has. It would get too mushy. The arch top died fast. It had a quick decay. So it would cut real good, and it just, you know, it made that. But I never understood, because I thought, why don't you just use a Martin? God, it sounds really great. Just strum the, but that's not their function.
Sure, the archtop is really succinct. I mean, pop, you know, every little nuance. And like you say, you take it out of the mix, and you wonder, you know, where are my shoes? What happened? You know, it's like riding on a train.
Right.
You hear the ching, 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 and eventually it disappears. But it's always there, you know. It's always there. It's what makes everything happen, and you're absolutely true with when things when things started to distort. You know, I'm sure there were people thinking, "Hey, that's a great sound. Where can we use this sound?" And of course, with the advancement of the pickups, you know, and the humbuckers, which made things even more quiet, so they could even turn it up louder, and different speakers, you know, different tubes. There's so many variables, but the bottom line, it comes back to the player and his ability to not only perform the music, interpret the music, and play in a sound stage with, you know, maybe 75 other of the finest musicians, you know, in the world, and still make everything sound perfect. I'm really grateful to have lived through a generation where I've heard such great music, and I still love it, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so important that we think about it's when I think about some of these pioneers and some of these older gentlemen, they're almost like family, because I've been involved with the guitar, and like you have, you know, our entire adult lives, and you realize what they did. You know, they started like Eddie Lang's segment in the book, Starting a Path. It's exactly what he did. They were, you know, he had to hold that grass down. You know, he had to go in there with the guitar and, like you say, play fills. There was nothing for him to refer to. These guys were creating this stuff with their sheer talent and their ability, and plus playing these instruments are very difficult to play. Big arch top, big action, you know, big strings, not the greatest amplifiers or miking systems, but yet they made the point, and they created that sound of the guitar so eloquently that it just got into the hearts and minds of so many people. Mm-hmm. That I think the small amount of musicians that played all these tunes, they're responsible for so many careers, the excellent standard of music in our country, and creating avenues for all of us, really. And you know, everything has a beginning, and you know, I don't care how, you know, straight laced it might sound, whatever, to do that in the studio and to be that precise and to work around the clock doing, you know, an album in 3 hours. Now people take 3 years or more to make an album,
right?
You know, it was a different world back then, when it was talent, everything was talent driven. You know, the guitar players, just like the violin players and all the horn players, that was their job. You know, they went to work, they rolled in, and they started playing.
Well, and people, you have to remember, the from reading in your book, because you go into depth with a lot of these different players, several of them were very well musically trained. Their music theory skills alone were phenomenal. But they were amazing readers. Yeah. I mean, and you have to understand, in a studio situation, you'll come in and you'll basically will knock off a tune in like one or two rehearsals, maybe three. Mm-hmm. And if you're doing a film score, it's usually let's run through it. Okay, let's record. And with when you're playing with an orchestra, and this, you know, Tommy Tedesco used to talk about the pressure.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you don't want to flub when you have 102 people playing with you. The cost of redoing that is going to be like, you know, astronomical, and it's going to be on your head. So these guys were, but they were just pretty, they would just literally would take a look at this music that just was just put in front of them, psych it out, go through a rough rehearsal, and boom, and nail it. Mm-hmm. And to do that, it's an art. It's different. Like, for example, you know, your Eric Clapton or your B.B. King or something, you know, great players, phenomenal phrasing, great feel. But they're, you know, they rehearse, they play their thing, they write their songs, they do what they do, and they're great. But to be able to do that like that in a snap, to just look at this and make this work, you know, and it used to amaze me, you know, like in guitar player, Tommy Tedesco used to show some of the sessions that he did, and it was amazing, you know, looking back at that. But even these guys, how they were able in a moment's notice, especially in a film score, to make art. And that's not easy to do. I'm not that fast. I mean, I've done session work and I've done that stuff, but to really make it special, they were worth every penny. As a musician, you know, like Bob Bain, I mean, what he did in the afternoons, they would come in and they would see whatever they were going to play, you know, and you know how diverse the musical guests were for Johnny Carson. It was mm-hmm. unreal.
Sure.
And that's every day, Monday through Friday, he would go in, boom, okay, that's it. And then they would just look at it, maybe do a couple, you know, check, okay, so you're going to, and then make notes. And then they didn't even play it again. They stopped and it was the night. That's great. That's incredible. And they're on TV and, you know, the cameras are on them. I mean, that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, and that's Bob coming from, you know, a session at Warner Brothers that afternoon.
Yeah, and he took off and he's doing other work. So yeah. He's coming back. He's not refreshed. He's been working all day. And he just, boom.
Yeah.
You know, that's incredible. I mean, people don't really understand. That's what you know, that's what made them stand out. It's one thing to sit down and record, but and record somebody else's stuff. But it's another thing to take that and make it into an artistic statement where it becomes the hit that you hear. And all that stuff that all those guys that played on Sinatra stuff or even the earlier stuff with Bing Crosby, Benny Goodman, all of the big band stuff, it's art. I mean, it's obvious that it's a bar above, you know, just normal. I mean, it's fantastic stuff.
Well, absolutely. You mentioned Bob, and Bob and Al Hendrickson did many, many, many gigs together. And when they would go in and record cues for movies, they're working on a session together, they would challenge each other. They would flip all the cues upside down, and then Bob would just flip it up, put it on, record it, boom. Next one, Al would pick it up, never saw before, just flip it over and just do the whole session like that. I mean, it's really unbelievable how many people can do that and make it happen and make it musical and interpret the composition the way it's supposed to be interpreted and make it sound lush and perfect. It's, you know, like I say, it's like a racehorse versus a quarter horse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got one that's out in the field breaking its back and doing what it's supposed to do. And then you have this other one that has been trained and allowed to run free and express itself. And when I think of these guitar players in the studio with everybody else around them, again, without the auto tunes and pitch correcting and all this enhancement stuff, it was just talent. It was just sheer talent. You know, interpreting eight notes of music, you know, it could be a wedding scene. It could be a Greek wedding. It could be a war scene. Still eight notes. But they can interpret it and make it sound and give it the attack and the emotion required. And that's something very special that not very many people possess, to have that kind of a interpretation facility as a studio musician.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you hear people say, well, studio musicians, they play other people's music, you know it's not creative. I say, well, you try to interpret somebody else's material and make everybody happy and then go home, you know, and just come in the next day and do it all over again, play on soundtracks and whatever.
It's a different type of artistry because it's not, it's taking something and making it unique. Mm-hmm. You know, working with a singer, you know, how you play can definitely affect, as you know, you probably have done sessions with singers. Mm-hmm. If you have the magic, it's there and makes them better and they sing better. You know, you kind of complement each other.
That's a great point. With Bob and Audrey Hepburn, who did the Moon River, and she really wasn't a singer, and Bob just took her aside, had her relax, and they ran through maybe one or two takes, and that the rest is history. That's what you hear, and it's a timeless classic by a non-singing actress who just nailed it. But I'm telling you, Bob has a way of bringing out the best in people, and he's not only is a great musician, a great humanitarian, great everything. He is so genuine about his interest that it makes you, it has the artist relax. And he would do that early country music too. They would bring these guys out of Nashville that didn't know anything about music, and so he had to sit them down and flesh out the tunes with them, and like Ferlin Husky and people like this. The next thing but they really didn't know exactly what to do at all. This is before the Wrecking Crew now.
Right, right.
Way back in the early days and there were a few guys, and like Bob became even more popular, you know, as a composer and a producer, because he was able to grab that from the artist and have them relax and produce these great songs.
Well, a lot of singers, I'm trying to remember which guitarist, because so many guitarists with so many artists,
yeah.
I get confused. But there was a guitarist that used to play for Bing Crosby, and he would do like a song where he would do there would be an intro, and he just liked it. There's some story in the book where he talks about where he always, after that one gig that this guy did, and he just, whatever he played, it just worked for Bing. That's all he wanted. He just wanted him. And he kept trying to, you got to tour with me, you got to tour with me, you got to tour with me.
That's their signature sound. When people hear that guitar, they hear Bing. You know, they work together. And that's what's great about the artists back then. There really was a tight relationship with a bond, if you will, with the musicians and the artists. Of course, that's all changed now. Everything's on files and this and that and the other thing. But back then, the artists and the performers, you could hear the continuity, you know, there was something special going on during these recordings. I never get tired of listening to it. It doesn't matter when it was recorded. I can appreciate the talent and the ability of making all that happen and making our music, some of the greatest music ever, just recorded, period. And being a guitar player, I think of doing a live gig, and I think of being in a room with all these other phenomenal players, and the clock is ticking, and the red lights are on, and there's a producer sitting over there, and all this. But boy, the focus, I've seen these guys, I've been to a couple sessions like with Mitch Holder and some of these people, and you just watch them. And Jeff, if you put your hand between them and the music, it would burn a hole through your finger. I mean,
right,
they're
right.
So focused, and it's actually incredible to watch. It's incredible. They are so dedicated. Whether it's a 5 second cue for a commercial, one sustained chord, it doesn't matter. Every note is given the same amount of talent and incentive and emotion. It's all there, and they never change, and that's why some of these guys have been around for so long. When Bob was in the studio, well, talk about an early Wrecking Crew player like Glenn Campbell. Now Glenn Campbell's one of those phenomenons that pretty much self-taught, but they would play through a tune once and say, okay Glenn, you take it, and that was it.
Yeah,
and he actually would sing during the breaks, and Bob and a few other people talked to A&R man Ken Nelson and said, "Listen, this Glenn Campbell, he's something special. You should do something with him." And they paired him up with Jimmy Webb, and the rest is history.
Right.
But there aren't as many of those guys coming down the pike as there were. And I think because everything has changed, you know, so much has changed. That's why I think it's important that when I talk to young people about, you know where this came from. Have you ever heard a big band? You listen to this stuff. You may not be crazy about it, but it's part of what you're doing. It all starts. You know,
is a
little tributary.
Well, one of the things I've talked to people about that, you know, a lot of people are doing punch-ins and they're doing all sorts of, you know, using the technology. It's really easy to manipulate and fix things. And I've done it too. With good editing, you can really make something phenomenal. But one of the things I was talking to Don Randy about, and he mentioned it too, is when you recorded in the old days on tape, you had to at least play the phrase. So you had to, you know, and that's a key thing. With these guys, where you're talking about that interpretation, that artistry, making it special, the phrasing and you know, so they would play the piece. They would perform the piece. Now, you know, when you do a lot of overdubbing, which it can be a performance if you know, there are people that still play out the song and they might punch in a fix here and there. But a lot of stuff is done chopped up. You know, they'll do this little segment like, okay, here's a guitar part. I'll sample that and put that in there. You know, so it's a piecemeal. And you lose that feeling of that interpretation of the song or the development of the song. And that's a key part of that era. And even when we were overdubbing in the 70s and stuff like that, and we had more tracks, we still played the part. And we performed the part. It was the recordings of especially these live, they were live recordings, the ones that you're talking about with the one microphone. There was no overdubs. Those were live, they were performances.
Yeah.
And that's a big difference. And also in the mindset of the guitar player, the session player, it's a performance. It isn't the same as, you know, just piecemealing, okay, I'm just going to hit this drone string or, you know, some of the multi-track layering where you would do like, you know, little minute pieces. And that was one of the things that Don kind of missed, is that, you know, especially he loved playing with the section, you know.
Sure.
You know, and that, but it's, you know, my recommendation to new players out there, if you're using a Pro Tool system or whatever, is phrase. Play the phrase. Play the melody. Play part A. Play the whole chorus through. Whether it's the rhythm part or you're playing a lead or whatever, because you'll find that you'll phrase differently than if you just try to punch here. Sure. Yeah, I like these first two bars. Okay, let me figure out what I'm going to do next. You'll hear the discontinuity in it, whereas you get this melodic. And that's the thing about these guys, is they were performing. It's a performance.
Absolutely.
That's the difference. But what I want to ask you,
yes,
was Bob the main, you know, there's the jazz players that got into session work, and a lot of them got in it because they could read and, you know, they had played in bigger sections. But who was really like the pioneer of the session work that led like to the Wrecking Crew? Was it Bob Bain, would you say? Or because you had, you know, I mean, like Barney Kessel played a lot of stuff and all these guys, George Barnes, Eddie, Tony Ricci, you know, who was the guy that you would say really kind of defined the session player?
Well, I would kind of bias with Bob Bain, only because there's an album, and I actually have a copy of it here. It's called Rockin' Rollin' and Strollin'.
Mm-hmm.
It was recorded, I think, in 56 or 58, where he was playing his Telecaster, which had been modified with a humbucker. And I would almost venture to guess that some of the earliest rock and roll, just straight-laced rock and roll twang of a Fender guitar, you'll hear any place.
Mm-hmm.
And so that opened a lot of doors.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, all his nylon string playing, the people that he was playing with. You got to remember, Bob started with the big bands, Tommy Dorsey, Les Brown, all these guys, Louis Belson. Then he was involved with early radio, Kraft Music Hour, which was nationally broadcast, and he also played and he sang. And then he got into early television, and that stretched out into movies, and then The Tonight Show. So generations have heard Bob's guitar. And the point you made earlier about performances is so true. The music now with the machines and everything, it's there's a lot of great stuff with technology. Don't get me wrong. I think it's wonderful what you can produce. But there's an element that's missing. When I listen to soundtracks from older films or movies, what have you, you know, people forget, they hear you hear the music playing, but there's human beings playing that. I mean, there's human beings, while they're playing, they're breathing, you know. And that's an element that human essence is in the music, whereas a lot of the programmable stuff, it's, you know, it doesn't breathe. You know, it's kind of, some of it's monotone. And, of course, there's ways of enhancing that, and there's ways of changing things. But it floors me to think of a performance in a studio. See, I think of it as this way. You have the music, you have the conductor, and then the musicians breathe life into it. You know, it's like that's where the music is born.
Yeah. You know, but look at what you just said. You know, in the 20s, I think it was in the 20s that radio became really big. Mm-hmm. And there was movies, but movies were silent at that time. So radio, most radio, they would try to do it live. There was no tape back then. So all of it was done live, and it was cut live on a lathe, onto a disc, transcriptions. And so it was a live performance. And same thing with the records. They would go in and they would you know, rehearse and get everything done and put the whole band together, one or two mics, and basically that was it. They would run the albums. So those early albums were live performances. Everything was performance-driven. And then even later when there was sound to movies, they didn't have all the tracks. They would do it. So they had to get it all at the same time. So the performance, the orchestra, those studio orchestras became even as competent, if not more, than a lot of the major orchestras, because they were constantly playing as an ensemble and they were doing incredible stuff. I mean, today, a lot of the studio orchestra members are part of the LA Phil, or, you know, like in LA, for example, they're members of other orchestras. So it's kind of the same guys. But back, you know, you have to remember those guys before. You know, orchestras were different. If you were in a classical orchestra, that's what you did. And then these other guys were basically in, you know, they were doing all these sessions. But it's incredible to pull together a 60-piece or 80-piece group of people to play that tight. And, you know, we look how amazing the Wrecking Crew as a rhythm section with like six or eight guys. Mm-hmm. But they would work and function with all those studios musicians, all those different instruments. They would just pull it together, like, you know, look at it. Okay, these are the parts. You know, make some notes here. All right, let's roll it. Boom. And it's a performance. And it's a live performance. You know, that speaks for itself. That's not an easy thing to do, and it's a unique talent.
It's a very unique talent, Jeff. And It's a blessing. I mean, you could have, like we said earlier, they're totally schooled and totally trained, but you still have to interpret. You machines can't interpret, you know. So these musicians, guitarists, everybody involved, and guitarists, for me, it's they're the new guys on the block. You know, they came out, and of course the technology boosted them up. So they had a lot to prove to a certain degree. And thank goodness that we had these amazing players, maybe 20, 30 guys over the years that played on just about everything. Mm-hmm. You know, TV commercials, you know, jingles, television, radio, movies, and doing live performances as well on occasion. But it's a small group of people. You know, it's like a baseball team that's played every game and every team over the planet, mm-hmm. and played it well. And I just have a lot of respect and admiration for these guys, and I think that's what compelled me mm-hmm. to do this and put it together, try to get some education out there about where things began and how far we have come as mm-hmm. far as music.
We're almost out of time, but I wanted to mention real quick before we go into talking more how to get the book and stuff. After you wrote the book, what did you discover after the fact that you wish you could have put in the book? Any interesting stories?
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's funny. In fact, you mentioned yourself. There's always someone. Not that you intentionally forget,
right?
But there's so many guys and so many things, and I tried to put as much as I could in the book. I wanted the readers not only to understand who these players were, but if you know, they're human beings first. You know, they're great musicians, but you know, they all start the same way, mm-hmm. and it's how they conducted their lives, and I try to express that in the book, and I've had a lot of positive comments from readers who had no idea, because a lot of the stuff in the book, to be honest, you won't find any place else,
mm-hmm.
you know, and a lot of the photos you won't find anywhere else. These are private collection of Bob Baines and things like this, and the information in there. Of course, some of the people I talked about have already passed on, so I would talk in depth with spouses, sons,
mm-hmm.
daughters, and so they were giving me this information that I thought, well, you know what, it's not only their talent, you know, it's who they are as people that, you know, supports that talent. And I think it's like Chick Corea used to say, you know, you want to be a great player, but you got to take care of your mind too, and I think it all combines into a really great product. And But back to your question, yeah, there's plenty of other people that I do intend to put in my volume two, more strings,
There definitely has to be a volume two.
Yeah, more strings, more memories.
Yes.
but there's quite a bit, and it's really great to see some of these films. You know, of course, Denny Tedesco's Wrecking Crew, 20 Feet from Stardom, and there's a Grant Green film out now about Pat Martino. It's so wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even that Coco film that's out, I see commercials now with kids playing guitars on television.
Yeah.
How great is that? You know, and I think that's a plus. If I can see an instrument in a kid's hand.
No, yeah. Well,
I love
that's
it.
Our future. And I a lot of musicians and a lot of younger musicians that are younger than myself are expressing that now because it's a legacy.
Yeah.
When we were kids, we had guitar heroes. We had something to look forward to that inspired us to pick up the guitar.
Sure.
We're not seeing that as much now, but they need to see more. And a lot of people, for example, they think that guitar is dead. It isn't. It's quite alive. And there's a lot of people playing. And they're good. And they're very good at it. But that's so important. I do agree with you. That's really an important thing. The name of the book is Strings of Memories. You can get it everywhere, and it's available on it's published by Island Born Press, and it's just an amazing book. It's great, and I hope you write another one because this is really important to get a feel. Like for example, Don Peake was on the show, and he mm-hmm. brought his archtop Gibson ES-250, I think it was, that he bought from Ray Pullman.
Oh my gosh!
Another guy, mm-hmm. another big session guy,
yeah.
And it's like. He had Ray Pullman's guitar. I mean, I fortunately through school and my teacher Duke Miller, who was another session guy at Universal, he was the one who told me about all these different players. That's why I knew about it. But I mean, it's part of history. Those are the instruments, you know, and the development of the jazz guitar, like the L5. All these guys that you talk about in this book were instrumental into developing that instrument, which is a great guitar.
Yeah,
and I have a Barney Kessel, so I'm proud of that.
Good
so.
For you.
But anyway, give real quick information. Your website is stringsofmemories.com?
Stringsofmemories.com. I've also got a couple of pages on Facebook, and there's a page on Facebook called the Brotherhood of the Guitar, which
yes.
I established as a global act of solidarity. With the changes that have been made in music, I think as musicians, as guitarists especially, we just need to be more family united. You might not be crazy or I might not be crazy about certain styles of music, but I can certainly appreciate the talent and ability to play that music.
Mm-hmm.
And so If you would, Jeff, I would like you to take the pledge that's on the back of that card.
Okay. And that is, I pledge allegiance to the brotherhood of the guitar and to the music played upon its strings. Each chord, every note, with rhythm, melody, and harmony for all.
See,
amen.
Now you are in. You are part of the brotherhood. And if anybody's interested, the Brotherhood of the Guitar on Facebook. And I've got fans all over. Tommy Emmanuel's a fan. A lot of really important
people.
Yeah,
he posts some really interesting stuff. And then also, too, you can check out. He also posts some photos of some of these guys and playing. And when you check out the book, the photos in the book of the different guitars and stuff. And, I mean, the book alone, just on Bob Bain, is worth it. But there's so much more. I mean, he talks about Dan Sawyer, Michael Anthony, George During, Al Hendrickson, which you mentioned, Mitch, John Kerwick, Tim May, and Tommy Rotella. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff in the back section where he just go through all these guys and they talk about their studio experiences and stories. It's very fascinating.
Thank you.
So anyway, check that out. This is a great book. It's kind of the prequel to The Wrecking Crew, and it's very good. And then you'll start understanding where the arch top went and what it does and its function. And I think you better appreciate that guitar and the tones that you can, especially with the new pickups and stuff. It's really interesting. And then somebody like Bob Bain with the Telecaster, I mean, he was one of the prime guys. I mean, he definitely helped Fender with that. So
absolutely.
Okay, everybody, have a great one. We will see you next week. Thank you again, Jim, for that.
Thank you, Jim.
Everybody have a good night.
All right, good night.